Foreign Secretary, welcome to the lectern.
Well, can I just begin by thanking Philip Barton for all the work he has done. 30 years of public service. He is the personification of public service on behalf of our country, for which we are incredibly grateful. And I particularly am grateful for the way you have led the transition for this new government over the last 6 months. And I think we all wish you a very, very happy retirement. So 6 months after becoming Foreign Secretary, I've gathered you here in the Foreign Office to talk about the future. But I want to begin by looking back, because it was here that Ernest Bevin developed a plan that has kept us safe for almost 80 years. 6 months after Attlee's great government began in January 1946, Bevin steered into the geopolitical fog at that time. The Second World War had only just ended. It was hard to see 6 months, let alone 6 years, ahead. But Bevin did not sit waiting for the fog to clear. He was a minister of action, who saw that what matters is not just what Britain says, but what it does. What matters is not just what Britain wants, but what it builds. And what matters, what makes us matter, is having a strategy. Which is why Attlee's manifesto was called Let Us Face the Future. In foreign affairs, this meant pooling defences in a new transatlantic alliance, acquiring a nuclear deterrent which still protects the UK and NATO, and a robust commitment to international law and new institutions like the United Nations. A strategy that was both progressive and realist, that took the world as it is, whilst working for the world that we want to see. Today, we must face the future once again with our plan for change. Fixing the foundations of economic stability, secure borders, and national security, so that we can deliver the priorities of hard-working people and a decade of national renewal. But to succeed in that task, we must navigate an increasingly volatile world to deliver at home. And this department must deliver our international strategy abroad. Such a strategy is not about crystal gazing on what might happen next week in X or Y or in the Middle East. That's not what I'm focused on today. Rather, I want us to be looking at how we can get a more progressive 2035, and that means confronting some hard truths about the state of the country, about the state of the world, and the need for reform. First, we must recognise that foreign policy begins at home. Britain's influence under the Tories was at a very low ebb. The Conservatives' foreign policy legacy may be less tangible to voters than, of course, NHS waiting lists, but it was just as damaging. Relations with our closest neighbours in Europe plunged to a post-war nadir. Climate leadership was abandoned by Rishi Sunak. Global investors were horrified by Liz Truss's kamikaze budget. Migration was left out of control, and there was a botched merger of this department under Boris Johnson. And political gridlock under Theresa May undermined the negotiating ability that most of the world considered us to be brilliant at. And of course, our armed forces were damaged after David Cameron's cuts. And the SCDO was rudderless, with 7 foreign secretaries in 7 years. Second, we have to accept that there is no going back. We must stop the 1990s clouding our vision, the post Cold War peace is well and truly over. This is a changed strategic environment. The number of conflicts higher than at any time since 1945. The spectre of famine from Gaza to Sudan, and the most refugees and displaced people on record. I'm occasionally asked on my travels here and, of course, on the doorstep around the country, when will the Kremlin threat, this upheaval that we're experiencing, end? When will things get back to normal? My answer is that they will not. Europe's future security is on a knife edge. Bevin warned in 1948 that we would only preserve peace by mobilising such force, and I quote, as we will create confidence and energy on the one side and inspire respect and caution on the other. And this is exactly what we need now. That's why our foreign policy has had to change. Inspired by Bevin, I call our new approach progressive realism, taking the world as it is, not as we would wish it to be, advancing progressive ends by realist means. Through a storm of crises, we've been putting this into practice. In Europe, progressive realism means working with our European neighbours rather than bickering and isolating ourselves from them. New defence and migration agreements with Germany, an ambitious UK-France summit in the works, a new era in relations with Ireland, a new foreign policy dialogue with the European Union, the first steps towards a UK-EU security pact. With the United States, our closest ally, progressive realism means strengthening our friendship with both sides of the aisle, joining them to defend Israel from Iranian attacks, together with Australia, further progressing the AUKUS partnership and making a breakthrough for UK defence companies thanks to the ITAR changes. Against Russia, progressive realism means not allowing Putin's mafia state to act with impunity and showing the world our resolve to stand by Kyiv until they prevail, guaranteeing $3 billion a year in military aid for as long as it takes, and unlocking a new funding backed by frozen Russian assets, as well as stepping up action with allies on Kremlin disinformation and making it my personal mission to choke off Russian revenues through our sanctions, imposing the most of any country against Russian shadow fleet and driving forward our campaign against kleptocracy. In the face of conflicts in the Middle East and beyond, progressive realism means standing firm against terrorism and behind international law, doubling our aid for Sudan, helping hundreds of Brits leave Lebanon, restoring funding for UNRWA, standing up for international courts, taking tough decisions on export licenses, but not flinching from defending Israel against an Iranian regime that wants to destroy it, while at the same time working for that ceasefire in Gaza so we can surge in the aid, bring all the hostages home, and advance a two-state solution. And when it comes to China, progressive realism means consistency, not oscillation. As I set out when I was visiting Beijing, and Rachel Reeves is continuing this week, pragmatic engagement to cooperate with China where we can, such as on trade, climate, global health, or AI regulation, but also very robust dialogue and challenge where there are clear threats. Sanctioning Chinese firms who supply technologies to support Putin's war, working for the release of Jimmy Lai, calling for an end to human rights abuses in Xinjiang, an end to cyber attacks on the UK, and an end to sanctions on our parliamentarians. And on the climate and nature crisis, progressive realism sees global action as fundamental to our energy independence and national security. We've launched the Global Clean Power Alliance, bringing 12 countries on board in its first mission to turbocharge the rollout of clean energy and drive green jobs and investment at home. And with the Global South, progressive realism means working together, no more lectures, showing respect, renewing partnerships and new agreements like those that I've launched in India, in Indonesia, in South Africa and Nigeria. That's all just in the last 6 months. This is just the beginning, and I'm determined for my tenure to be more than the day-to-day crisis management kind of foreign secretary. That's why I want to lay out three realistic principles that will guide our foreign policy to get us to a more progressive 2035. First, we and our allies must relearn the Cold War manual: long-term thinking, not short-termism. Consistent deterrence, not constant distraction. Adapting as emerging technology reshapes the strategic environment. Securing strategic stability in an unstable world. Our opponents are coordinating ever more closely, with Iranian drones fired on Ukrainian cities and North Korean troops now fighting against Ukraine. We too need a whole new level of global engagement with our closest allies in the United States, Europe, and the Five Eyes. Our strategic partners in Japan and South Korea, and with all those committed to the principles of the UN Charter. That's why we will engage with China. We have to challenge them not to throw their lot in with Putin. And second, to be taken seriously by our opponents and allies alike, we must put our money where our mouth is. That starts by facing the facts. Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are simply right when they say that Europe needs to do more to defend its own continent. It's myopia to pretend otherwise with Russia on the march. So this government will lay out a clear pathway to reaching 2.5% of our GDP on defence. A figure, lest we forget, that the last Labour government met and was never met by the Tories since David Cameron's cuts. And with John Healey, we will lead and we will change to convince all of our NATO allies that rising defence spending is a strategic necessity. And third, we must forge closer partnerships with the Global South. Because the world is larger than the North Atlantic and the Mediterranean, we cannot divorce the Euro-Atlantic from the Indo-Pacific. And the Kremlin has spread its tentacles across the world, spewing out disinformation on every continent, dispatching mercenaries to Africa and seeking closer relations within the BRICS formation. A grim vision of unending competition is not compelling to the vast majority of states. We must avoid repeating the mistake of the early Cold War period, where the West lost ground to the so-called Third World. From Jakarta to Kampala, the non-aligned movement was the result. And today, many of those same states are structuring their foreign policy to avoid harm from US competition. To shape 2035, we must offer a new vision of partnership, which approaches those countries as equals, working with pioneers like Mia Mottley to reform the global financial system, more climate finance, delivered faster and with greater impact, is not a luxury, but a geopolitical necessity. Failing to deliver means failing the global south, and that only advantages Vladimir Putin. When the world changes, you need to see it as it really is. And the same goes for your institutions. Again and again, realism has meant progressive reform. The Harding Crowe reforms of 1905 created a modern policy bureaucracy which helped Britain keep pace with its rivals in the years preceding the First World War. The Eden reform of 1943, creating a modern diplomatic service during a world war, made it open to women for the first time, paid for the first time, and fit to keep the peace. And Robin Cook's foresight in 2000, first putting climate on the Foreign Office agenda. Over the last 6 months, I've seen in the FCDO the most dedicated public servants I've ever met in my life, working all over the world to avert disasters and bring countries closer together. But we must do more to harness the strengths of the Foreign Office and deliver the government's plan for change. And that's why I set in train 3 reviews. I'm very grateful to Martin Donnelly, to Neri Woods, to Manoush Shafiq for all of their work, into the FCDO's role and capabilities, looking particularly at our economic capability in this department, at our global impact in this department, and the fusion of development and diplomacy. And in each case, asking, how can we ensure that the tools at our disposal provide maximum benefits to UK prosperity and security? The stories of the reviews is a world where the foreign and the domestic, the political and the economic have blurred. Vladimir Putin has mastered this with his hybrid playbook, and this department needs to reflect this reality. That's why diplomacy and development belong together. While poverty reduction is an end in itself, our development work cannot be siloed off from geopolitics. And that's why I am reforming this department, connecting its work better to 2 domestic priorities of the British people that cannot be solved without work abroad: tackling irregular migration and boosting economic growth. On irregular migration, the FCDO is critical to trying to solve this issue. A realistic strategy involves transactional, hard-headed diplomacy, and to agree with partners smart interventions at every stage along the international people smuggling pathway. So together that we can strengthen borders, smash the gangs, and get those with no right to be here returned to their countries. There are those who have told me that this isn't a progressive issue. I'm afraid they're wrong. There is nothing progressive about leaving the most vulnerable exploiting, letting criminal gangs get rich and commit more crime on British streets. The greatest failure of the last government was that they told Britain they would take back control. But the truth is they lost control of our borders, and with it they lost and deserve to lose the confidence of the British people. Make no mistake, this government, from the Prime Minister down, see the challenge for what it is. And that's why I'm working so closely with Yvette Cooper, using our department's new joint irregular migration unit to deploy every tool at our disposal to restore control to our borders. Improving cooperation on returns is how we send people home. Conflict prevention is how we stop people fleeing their homes in the first place. Development work upstream is how we encourage people to stay in their homes, like the projects that we've now got in Albania, in Vietnam, and in Iraq. And we must use our sharpest diplomatic weapons to help restore control of our borders. Today, I'm very pleased to announce, after a lot of hard work, that the UK is to be the first country in the world to develop legislation for a new sanctions regime, specifically targeting irregular migration and organised immigration crime. This will help to prevent, combat, deter and disrupt irregular migration and the smuggling of migrants into the UK. That's us playing our full part on the issue of irregular migration. But what about growth? This department needs to change to help deliver and invest by 2035, the government's modern industrial strategy. When I visit the world's largest and fastest growing economies and the cities and regions which are driving their growth, it's crystal clear how much their businesses and investors want to work with us, particularly now that we've begun to rebuild the UK's reputation for economic competence. And this is true in Europe, where we're resetting, obviously, our ties following the Conservatives' paper-thin deal, as it is in the United States, the Gulf, and Asia. The SCDO's network needs to work hand-in-glove with the Department for Business and Trade and the Office of Investment to spot opportunities abroad and help overseas firms to grasp those opportunities from doing business with Britain. To get better at delivering on this agenda overseas, we need to recruit more diplomats with more private sector skills and experience, more expertise in sectors like tech, data, life sciences particularly, where the UK is at a cutting edge, more understanding of the everyday economy right across our country, not just in the City of London. And I'm making it a priority in my time in this job to get more of our staff with these skills and experience posted across the most important markets for UK growth, because we have a compelling story to tell of the world's second largest exporter of professional and business services, with four of the world's top 10 universities and ranking first in Europe when it comes to tech unicorns. And one of our great strengths, of course, are our creative industries. Again, unfortunately, too often maligned by the Conservatives, which account for almost 15% of our service exporters, as well as being a force multiplier for wider British influence. Influence through their power to attract, not to compel. Together with Lisa Nandy, I'll therefore shortly be launching the new UK Soft Power Council, so that the government can be a partner to those in business and beyond who are so important for our prosperity at home and our standing abroad. Across both these priorities, we will do much more quickly, if we embrace the greatest enabler of our time, technology. I'm less interested in admiring the SCDO as a historic institution than fulfilling its potential to be a cutting-edge institution, which is why I'm also planning to bring AI into the heart of our work. By the end of this Parliament, our reform agenda will deliver a radically reshaped organisation with redeployed resources and a completely modernised way of working. I believe that AI can be transformative for the practice of diplomacy, and I'm determined for the Foreign Office to be a pioneer in harnessing its power. An upgraded data science team will sit at the core of this office, bringing more empirical rigour to everything that we do. This is not a far-fetched vision. The capability, frankly, already exists, in use by our friends in the United States, and even some departments already in Whitehall. Now is the time to mainstream it, liberating more diplomats from their desks in the UK and getting them out into the global network, combating irregular migration and driving growth, delivering for hardworking people at home. Friends, this country has had its mettle tested before. Often there have been those who've written us off. But British leaders saw our potential, and in their plans for change, they pulled out strength and depth from within us. In 1946, amid the ruins of the war, Bevin and his colleagues built NATO and the National Health Service. In the 1960s, Harold Wilson embraced, of course, the white heat of technology. And in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher unleashed the City of London. And as I entered politics, it was Tony Blair modernising Britain at home and abroad. In 2025, we need to look within and see our power and our potential. Our potential to secure our borders and reform the National Health Service, our potential to unlock growth and drive the clean energy transition, our potential to reconnect with the world through a foreign policy which enables and empowers change at home and through a long-term international strategy. We can be realists and optimists. We can seize the opportunities coming into view, and we can show the world what a more progressive 2035 can be like, and deliver the promise of a decade of national renewal. Thank you very much.